You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
By the way, I have a 23andMe kit sitting on my desk that a well-meaning friend bought two on Amazon Prime Day, so should I go ahead or not?
It's funny. So many people say to me, I have it sitting on my desk or I have it sitting on my counter, and they often let it sit there for quite some time. I think it's important for people who do this to know that there are possibilities that there will be surprises that aren't as simple as third cousins that they didn't know about, or some little sliver of geography or ethnicity that they hadn't known. I mean, that's how it's marketed, but it can be much more complex.
Yeah, I have to think about it. I sort of prefer the mystery rather than having it all taken away. But
I would say one thing beyond that too, though, which is that I think the complexity of it ultimately, I mean, for me, ultimately, it has been really liberating to know the truth.
I'm John Burnham Schwartz, literary director of the Sun Valley Writers Conference, and this is Beyond the Page. Like most of you, save for those true heroes who right now are battling the pandemic in hospitals, nursing homes, and makeshift public health clinics around the country and across the globe, I am sheltering at home with my family, practicing social distancing, which in this case means recording this and future episodes in my home office, surrounded by my favorite books. Among those books is Inheritance, one of the most engrossing, moving, and insightful memoirs I've read in the past several years, in which, near the beginning, the author Danny Shapiro pauses to reckon with an epiphany in the form of a question. How had I lived my life, she writes, without being able to answer the first and most fundamental of all questions? Who am I? It's a question almost biblical in its timelessness, and yet, seen through the prism of the astonishing personal odyssey that Danny recounts in Inheritance, it's a question that has never been more timely or relevant to the particular moral quandaries of contemporary life and science. As Danny tells best-selling author and physician Abraham Verghese in this episode, the road to her life-altering experience began on a whim, by taking a test that may be familiar to many of you listening.
You know, it seems to me, just to kick this off, that there's always been a vein in your writing of a quest, a search for who you are. I mean, it pops up again and again in your memoir, and it also pops up in your novels. And there was a piece you wrote in the New York Times Book Review in 2016, and this is before all the events that you're about to tell us about. And the title of the piece was, "When You Write a Memoir, Readers Think They Know You Better Than They Do."
Their title.
And as it turned out, there was stuff that you had to know about yourself that you weren't yet aware of. So please take us through that charged moment when your life changed.
Funny that you mentioned that piece, though, Abraham, because though I had written it before my discovery, the Times Book Review tends to take a long time to get to things, so it came out as my discovery was unfolding. So that was just a strange turn of events. So in June of 2016, in the winter of 2016, my husband, just on a whim, decided to have his DNA tested, and he asked me if I wanted to do it too. I've come to think of this as recreational DNA testing. He asked me if I wanted to do it too, and I could so easily have said no, but instead, I just shrugged and said sure. The companies tend to bring prices down right before the holidays, and it was inexpensive, and I just thought I would go along with it. When my results came back, they first revealed that my the breakdown of my ethnicity was very different than what I would have thought it would have been. I come from an Eastern European Ashkenazi Jewish family, and the breakdown was more like 50% that, and 50% altogether different Western European. So that's where that began.
That's where that journey began. You had some hints that, looking back from your mother, that there might have been a little mystery there. Do you want to elaborate on that?
So a couple of things happened in very quick order after that initial breakdown. And one was that my husband was much more surprised and interested and taken with that breakdown than I was. I just figured there must be a logical explanation that had nothing to do with my paternity or anything like that. But he suggested that I have my DNA compared, there's a way of doing this very simply, with that of my half-sisters. My father had a child from a first marriage, and she's much older than I am, and we weren't really in close touch, but I reached out to her. She had done 23andMe, I did Ancestry.com, but we were able to compare them very easily. And as I write in the book, it took a fraction of a second for the results to come back, and the results were that we were not related. And that's where it began for me. I realized that that meant that my dad, who raised me and who I adored, and who died when I was 23, had not been my biological father. But in that moment, I didn't think, well, that must mean my mother had an affair. I mean, that would be the logical thing that most people would think in that moment. I went back in my mind to a conversation that I had had with my mother that remained with me. It was, I think sometimes when there's a really important conversation or moment in our lives, even if we don't know consciously that it's important, little recording device starts worrying in the back of our minds. And that was true for me. I remembered everything about this conversation. My mother, I had taken her with me to a reading, and I had introduced her to a graduate student that I was reading with, who was from Philadelphia. And my mother said, oh, that's funny, my daughter was conceived in Philadelphia. And it's a very strange thing to be 25 years old and hearing for the first time at a reading the story of your conception. And I said, Mom, what are you talking about? I've never heard that. And she said, oh, it's not a pretty story. Which tells you something about my mom. But I pushed her that evening. I told her she could not just leave it as that the story of my conception was not a pretty story. And that evening she told me that my parents had had trouble conceiving, that they had gone to an institute, that was the word she used, not clinic, not hospital, she said institute, in Philadelphia. And that there was a doctor there who could had pioneered what later became the LH test that would tell exactly where a woman was in her ovulation cycle. And then my father would come racing down, her words, from New York City where he worked, and they would do the procedure. And I was driving as she was telling me this, and I said, what procedure? And she said, artificial insemination. But there's a huge world of genetic difference between artificial insemination and donor insemination. She made it very clear to me that it was my father's sperm that had been used in that procedure.
I mean, that must have been something that you tucked away, and at this moment when you get the 23andMe results and you compare them with your sister's, it all comes flashing back.
Talk
a little bit about how you discovered that, in fact, it must have been a donor insemination.
So again, back around the time that my mother and I had that conversation, I went to my half-sister and I asked her if she had known anything about the circumstances of my parents and their infertility, and she hadn't. She said, no, I didn't, but you might want to look into that further. I do know something about the history of reproductive medicine in this country, and there was a practice in those days of mixing sperm. I like to look at a crowd when I say that. Two words that do not belong together in a phrase. It's like Mad Libs. They would take donor sperm and they would mix the sperm with that of the intended father in order to protect the father from ever really knowing whether the child was biologically his. And this was a practice. It was actually called confused artificial insemination.
And they called it a treatment. It was a treatment for slow sperm.
Right. This is something that I found out later, but the concept of mixing sperm that had been introduced to me by my half-sister decades earlier came roaring back when I was suddenly faced with the knowledge that she and I were not related, that I was... I knew that it meant that my biological father was a sperm donor.
Few words are more loaded in our present culture than identity. For all its various meanings, though, politics, ethnicity, gender, the word at its most fundamental is almost always an expression of some kind of belonging. Where do I come from? To whom do I truly belong? Who else in the world is most like me? For Dani growing up, and for her parents too, these questions were anything but simple.
You know, there are several moments in the book when different people, your relatives, Mark Strand, the poet, Mark actually confronted you in a sense, you know, looked across the table and said, "You're not Jewish." So you knew for a long time that you looked different, but you didn't really make too much of it. And I want to sort of emphasize for the listeners that you come from a very long Jewish tradition. You speak Hebrew. Your family was Orthodox, and you kept the Sabbath and so on. And yet you were from time to time confronted with the fact that you didn't look like the rest of your family.
Every day I was confronted with I didn't look like the rest of my family. It was really actually quite a formative part of my identity, because to be told every day that you're not who you think you are, or that in some way you don't belong. I mean, my way of adapting whenever anyone would say that to me was I'd kind of push back on it and talk about just how observant a family I came from, and that I went to a yeshiva, and I grew up speaking Hebrew, and we kept kosher, and there was this family history. And I would push back with that because I found it both offensive and disturbing. You know, we know now that it's so politically incorrect to say to someone, you don't look like where you know, who you think you are, where you come from, you know, where are you from, that kind of thing. But I really was faced with that every day. And I think it contributed to a sense of being other.
Mm-hmm. Your father comes across as an extraordinary man. I mean, truly, just a wonderful human being who suffered some really bad breaks, if you sort of cumulatively look at all the things that happened to him. Do you want to tell us a little bit about his sort of biography before you came into his life?
So my father, who I should say I've been writing about all my life, in some way or another as a writer, he's been who I've written to. I became a writer after he died. I started publishing after he died. I was always trying to understand and supply narratives to why he was so sad and in many ways absent, but also an extremely loving and warm person. But there was something, I had the sense that there was something that happened that I was always digging for and that I didn't understand. And when I was in my early 30s and I had just written my first memoir, Slow Motion, I realized that I had reached the same age at which point my dad, by the time he was in his early 30s, had been both divorced, which at that time was, and in the Orthodox Jewish community, was a huge thing. And then he was widowed. He met a young woman and fell, by all accounts, madly in love with her. And she was dying of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which was a death sentence in those days. She was 26 years old. And her parents kept it from her and kept it from my father as well. And he found out on the eve of their wedding that she was dying. And against rabbinic advice, he actually moved forward and married her and was widowed 6 months later. And this was a family secret. I wrote a piece about it for The New Yorker called The Secret Wife, in which I journalistically dug into everything I could to understand that period of time.
You know, the New Yorker piece that describes this is extraordinary. And I think what comes across is, I mean, it's a bioethical sort of nightmare in a sense that that one could think not to inform a patient. But at the time, that was the norm.
Well, it struck me that my father, over the course of his relatively short life, was at the center of not one but two bioethical conundrums, really.
But as I said, it says volumes about your father that then he would go ahead with the marriage against the advice or permission of the rabbi who said that he could postpone it indefinitely till she died, right? But he didn't do that, and it's just a remarkable story by itself. And then he meets your mother, and at this point, they're what age?
He is in his late 30s, and she's in her mid-30s when they meet. She had also been divorced, no children, which, again, in that time, in that world, was very unusual. And I think they were not particularly happy together. I think they maybe were happy at the very beginning. But I think they both experienced each other as the last best chance that they would have.
Yeah.
And so, it should also be said that my mother was an atheist, and she agreed to become religious in order to marry my dad. So there was a lot of conflict between them about religion, especially about how to raise me, their only child, which I thought I understood.
And they struggled to conceive. I mean, were you aware of that, that they were struggling to have a child, that they had had miscarriages and...
Yeah, that was a part of the narrative that I knew, and I understood myself to be their hard-won only child. You know, unusual to be an only child when I was growing up. I grew up in a suburban neighborhood where many of the families had 3, 4, 5 children. My high school English teacher's wife on Facebook, when she read about what my story was about, wrote a comment which was, hashtag always wondered.
Wow, yeah.
Only child, older parents.
Yeah.
But I never wondered. The narrative was they tried really hard to have me, which they did.
I want to sort of come to your coming to terms with this. You know, I think most of us can only imagine what that moment is like when you feel the bedrock of your whole narrative has shifted. But what is most amazing to me was that with a few keystrokes of Google from that 23andMe result, you were basically able to unravel this whole story.
Yeah, so it took 36 hours from the moment that I realized that my dad had not been my biological father until I had zeroed in on my biological father, using nothing more than Facebook and Google and a couple of hunches. My biological father was a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania, which was a hunch, because it was very easy to figure out the institute that my mother had referred to. There was only one place called an institute, and it was on the campus of Penn. And it was just a hunch, a hypothesis that I had along with my husband that it would have been a medical student. But it's shockingly easy more and more today because of the prevalence of DNA testing, the idea that someone in a family will have probably done it. You know, many people, as I've been on the road for the book, will say to me, well, I'm not going to do DNA testing because I don't, you know, I wouldn't want to be discovered or that kind of thing. And I'm in a position of saying to people, it doesn't really matter whether you do it or not. In the case of my biological father, a nephew of his had submitted his DNA, and so he showed up on my page as a first cousin. And then it was just about connecting the dots.
As Dani connects those dots, she steps fully into another unexpected chapter of her life, and at the same time, into a thicket of bioethical considerations that were nowhere in evidence in 1953 when Watson and Crick discovered the double helix of DNA, or a decade later when her mother underwent the then not uncommon process of confused artificial insemination, as it was called, via an anonymous sperm donor. Or in fact, until quite recently, when personal DNA kits like 23andMe and Ancestry.com began to be available to anyone with an internet connection and a credit card.
Last year, 12 million people bought these kits. That number is expected to exceed 100 million within the next 2 years. And each year, it's estimated that about 2%, and this is the part that these companies, it's not part of their marketing plan, but about 2% of the people who do these tests discover something called, as it's known in the industry, an NPE, which stands for not parent expected. So 2% of 240,000, I mean 2% of 6 million is 240,000 people a year who are making these discoveries right now, and that's part of what I'm seeing. And then there are all of these layers, because these are people who are, whose worlds are being rocked by, it's not so much not knowing who and where and what biologically and genetically they come from, it's realizing that they hadn't known what they hadn't known. In other words, for me, for example, I confidently gave incorrect medical information for my entire life. Father's medical history, I thought I knew it. I owned it. It was part of mine. I was carrying a medical history that wasn't mine, and for my child. So there are all of these different layers where there are these people making these discoveries. Then there are the parents, and I find this, there's so much heartbreak in this. There are the parents who were told, never tell your children. Go home, forget it ever happened. Great lengths were taken to allow parents to forget that it ever happened if they wanted to. Not just in a kind of denial way, but really just, it kind of goes away for a lot of people. And now those parents are confronted with the realization that their grown children are probably going to find out. It's so accessible. And then there are the donors, all of the anonymous donors who donated because they believed that they would be anonymous. And now they have offspring who are looking for them and finding them. And so a big part of this, I think, that's going to be ongoing and keeping bioethicists and psychologists and sociologists really busy for a couple of decades, is what is our moral responsibility to each other? The world changed, science changed, the human heart has not changed. And paternity, where we come from, we have a desire to know it. And I actually think, to the degree that we can, a right to know it. So there's so many, there's so much secrecy and so much subterfuge. And now, even today, there are parents who conceive children via donors who don't tell their children. And everybody's playing with fire because it's all available now.
Let's just set this. So what year are we talking about? Because I guess at one level you can understand that science and bioethics had not evolved to the point where they could anticipate such a thing as DNA testing. So what year was this taking place again?
My parents started to try to have a child in the late 50s, and I was conceived in 1961 and born in 1962.
But what is much less hard to grasp is the particular institute where this was happening. It sounds like a real fly-by-night sort of operation. Talk a little bit about this extraordinary individual who ran the place, Edmund Farris. You know, he was not a physician. He was a scientist. And
to set the stage for a little about that, there were places that were completely legit. This was happening at Yale. It was happening at NYU. It was happening at the Margaret Sanger Clinic in New York City. There were places around the country where this was, where donor insemination was happening in a hospital setting. My parents, for reasons that I will never know, chose to go to this institute called the Farris Institute for Parenthood on the campus of Penn. Edmund Farris was a scientist, but he was not an MD. So in fact, at some point during my research, when one of the doctors that I spoke with who was familiar with the whole landscape and Farris said, he was practicing medicine without a license, in fact. And then he died about 6 months before I was conceived. And when I realized that, that was really fascinating to me. So what did that mean? Well, as it turns out, his wife, Augusta Farris, who was a cookbook illustrator, put on a white coat and continued his work. There were doctors there at that point, actual MDs, performing the actual, Augusta wasn't inseminating women, but she was running the show. But they had very, very good results because of Farris's scientific acumen. So I think somehow my mother, who tended to go to the best of the best, my fantasy, I'll never know, but is that you know, a phone number or an address was just pressed into her hand with like, go see this guy. He'll get you a baby. He'll get the job done.
I think people definitely underestimate the process that it triggered in you to try and make sense of this, make meaning of this, especially because you identified much more with your father than your mother, who sounded like she was more difficult. But I think the most fascinating part of the book to me was your voyage of discovery and your coming to terms with how do you live with this information. And talk a little bit about that process of understanding this.
Yeah, I began researching and reporting almost instantly, in part because it was my way of trying to put myself back together again, and in part because I realized that anyone who might still know something, actually know something about how I came to be, was going to be very old. And Rabbi Lookstein, who's a very prominent rabbi in New York, knew my grandfather, knew my father. When I went to see him, at one point, once he understood what I was actually saying to him, he said to me, he asked me a question. He said, what story would ease your heart? And I said, the true one. But at that moment, my heart kind of sunk because I realized that his rabbinic desire was just to make me feel better. And I was at that point feeling like the only thing that would make me feel better was knowledge, as much knowledge as I could possibly have about what my parents had gone through, how much they had known, how they had made the choices that they did, whether, as I write in the book, whether the three of us were in the dark. My first idea was that my parents had been fooled by the Institute, you know, that they never knew. I couldn't get anybody on board for that particular fantasy of mine. But it was a preferable fantasy because it felt to me that then, as our little family, then we were all in it together. And then my next thought was, well, maybe my mother fooled my father. She would have been capable of that. And I also couldn't get anybody on board for that theory. Even people who didn't like my mother wouldn't. Like, they just, experts, doctors, rabbis, relatives, friends, scientists, people who really knew the history of reproductive medicine and the practices that went on, all believed that my parents had known. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to understand, well, then, what did that mean? What did that mean for us? There was a kind of re-remembering, re-understanding of our entire history together. And really in the book, very much, in the book and in my life, very much a journey to, at the very beginning, one of my mother's oldest friends, who was in her 90s, who I reached and spoke to, who was shocked. Really, my parents told no one. But she said to me at one point during our phone conversation, she said, Danny, no matter what, your father's still your father. It was 24 hours since I had found out that actually, in biological fact, that my father was not my father. And at the time, I knew she was well-meaning, but it felt to me like, well, walk a mile in my shoes right now, because right now I feel like my father was an anonymous sperm donor who I may never be able to find. My sense of otherness and isolation and differentness as a child kind of explained for the first time. A feeling of rending from my family that I was so identified with and my ancestors who I felt so connected with, and wondering whether I would ever feel that way again. And the journey really was one very much to understanding what makes a father, and that my father, if anything, I feel was even more my father than I did before I made this discovery, but I had to get there myself.
Inheritance is Dani's fifth memoir and 10th book, including 5 novels. And she would be the first to tell you that every meaningful story, whether reality or fiction, contains an unexpected character or two whose perceptive love helps the protagonist to see, finally, what she most fears has been lost.
I think the most important character in the book in terms of your understanding, my reading, was your Aunt Shirley. And so, if you wouldn't mind sort of setting the stage, and I'd love for you to read a little passage related to her.
So just to set this up a little bit, Shirley was, at this point, 93 and a half years old. It turns out that half birthdays become important after you're 90. When you're 2 and when you're 90 plus. And I was very ambivalent about going and seeing her and telling her what I had discovered. I'm very close to her. As I said, she's devout. She's a great-grandmother of I think, 70 great-grandchildren at this point. I was afraid that it would be too hard for her to hear this. She loved my father very much. My father was her older brother. So I fly to, but I decide to tell her, and I decide to go see her because I wonder if she knows something, and if there was anyone who might have known, who my father might have confided in, it would have been her. My car pulled away, and I walked up the front steps to my cousin Joanne's home, where Shirley now lived. This is in Chicago. Another car would pick me up in 4 hours. 4 hours in which I would tell my aunt, one who had once described herself to me as a weaver's daughter, that she and I were not threads in the same tapestry, that we were not related by blood, that her much-adored older brother was not my father. Joanne opened the door and ushered me inside warmly. I was still holding a Starbucks cup from the airport. Was Starbucks kosher enough? I wasn't sure. "Is this okay?" I gestured to the cup. If it wasn't, she didn't embarrass me. "Of course, Mom's been expecting you." Joanne led me into a sitting room, a desk surrounded by bookcases filled with leather-bound Hebrew volumes. On several long, polished tables, just had been the case in Shirley's home near Boston and in my grandmother's apartment in New York City, there were literally hundreds of family photographs. Being a part of this vast array had always comforted me, even as it had confused me. I was the lone, pale, blonde child in the sea of dark-haired, dark-eyed grandchildren and great-grandchildren, my otherness and difference glaringly evident. Yet I had never had any doubt that I was part of the chain that reached back and back through the generations, unbroken. As I stood in my cousin Joanne's sitting room, now knowing better, it felt as if the links of that chain were in pieces on the floor all around me. Shirley emerged from her living quarters behind the sitting room, and we held each other close. She wore a dark skirt and a gray silk blouse, her silver hair pulled back into a low bun. She was unadorned, no makeup, no necklace, no earrings, her plain gold wedding ring the only decoration on her elegant, supple hands. A Juilliard-trained pianist, she had still been able to sit at the keyboard and play Brahms ballads well into her 80s. She had become smaller with each passing year. As I hugged her, the top of her head rested beneath my chin. Shirley and I settled on the sofa in the living room. "I wonder if you know why I'm here," I began. She shook her head no. "I have a story to tell you, and I'm afraid you're going to find it painful." Shirley was so small, her back erect as she readied herself to hear whatever it was I had come to say. The house was dead quiet, so quiet I could hear a clock somewhere ticking, ticking. Was there any part of her that had always wondered if this day of reckoning would come? I began at the beginning. I told her I'd had my DNA tested. I looked for a flicker of awareness, a sense that she knew where this was going. I saw none. For the first time in my life, I understood the expression, blow by blow. "Do you need me to slow down?" I asked a couple of times. "Is there anything you don't understand so far?" I asked this not because I thought she had the slightest cognitive decline. She had one of the sharpest minds of anyone I knew, but she was 93. When she was born, automobiles were relatively new. Televisions did not exist. She was already the mother of four when Watson and Crick discovered the chemical structure of DNA. Another elderly person to whom I'd recounted the story had asked, "So you're saying you're part your father and part someone else?" Shirley grew even more still as I spoke. She reminded me of a tiny animal in the forest, big eyes, big ears, quivering with attention. I told her that the comparison of DNA samples revealed that Susie and I were not related by blood. We were not half-sisters. She didn't move. And then, "Shirl, did you know my parents had a hard time conceiving me?" "No, I didn't," she responded. There it was, my answer. She hadn't known. If my father had kept a secret, he'd kept it from his sister as well. I went on to tell her about Philadelphia, the Institute, my father's mad dashes from New York. As I spoke, a transcendent calm came over me, Some part of me broke off from the rest and marveled at this calm. So you're saying, Dad isn't my biological father, I said. Five words, and a lifetime. Her eyes were locked onto mine. I was afraid she was going to stop breathing. Not a blink, not a sound. I feared it was as if I had said to her, you're not mine, I'm not yours. We don't belong to each other. It felt violent. The world around us fell away. She leaned slightly forward, reached out, and grabbed my hand. I'm not giving you up, she said. The thin shell holding me together cracked, and suddenly I was weeping with my whole body. And you better not be giving me up, she said, every syllable deliberate. I'm not giving you up, Cheryl, I sobbed. I was so afraid that... I have fewer years ahead of me than behind me, she said, and you are my brother's daughter.
So there is the past, which of course is ever present. And Danny's present doesn't stop to wait for what she's now discovered. It keeps unfurling, suggesting a future she's not quite prepared for. Or is she?
It just went like click, 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 like I describe it in the book as those videos on YouTube of, you know, the kid who puts together the Rubik's Cube in, you know, 3 seconds. It was like that. It was so extraordinary. I mean, there was this first cousin. Using Facebook, we were able to find the first cousin. And I'm looking at this stranger who lives in Ohio, and there's pictures of cats and, you know, children and backyards, and we have no friends in common. And I'm realizing that if he is my first cousin, then an uncle of his would be my biological father. And so we look up a couple of search terms and find his mother's obituary. And his mother had passed away a few years earlier and was survived by quite a large family, including two brothers, one of whom was a doctor who lived in Portland, Oregon. And he's named in the obituary. Google, there he is. He is a retired physician and he's a medical ethicist. You know, I changed certain details to protect his privacy in the book, but that would have been a cheap shot to make that up. He's indeed a medical ethicist, and he was, the first time I laid eyes on him, it was on a YouTube video, and he was delivering a lecture at a college in the Pacific Northwest, and he was, it stands probably as what will remain the most surreal moment of my life. He was standing behind a lectern, which is something I do often. He was talking to an audience, which is something I do often. He was running a Q&A, which is something I do often. And the first thing that I noticed was that he was gesturing with his hands the way that I gesture with my hands. And that's what I saw. And I didn't see it in a sort of intellectual, I'm noticing this kind of way. I felt it in my bones. I was seeing the familiar. And I had never seen the familiar before. I mean, I actually do look a lot like him, but that's not what I was noticing. I was noticing that. And, you know, people ask me sometimes, did you deliberate for a long time before you reached out to him? About an hour. It felt essential to me. And yet at the same time, I was very careful in what I wrote. I found his email. He has a website. And I wrote him a very careful note. I don't know how I knew to be so careful, but I did. Making it very clear that I wanted nothing, asking him whether it made sense to him that it seemed to be that he was my biological father, letting him know how shocked I was and that I had always believed that my parents were both my biological parents, and asking him if he'd be willing to connect. And that's how it began. And then over the course of the book, I kind of detailed this very delicate dance back and forth between a 78-year-old retired physician with 3 children and a wife of 50 years who never knew he had been a sperm donor because it was not a big deal. You know, donors just donated and they didn't think about the living consequences of their donations for the most part. It was just considered a good thing to do, make a few bucks, actually spoken of as sort of like really nothing more than giving blood or know, donating a kidney or a retina, not considering that it actually meant, he never considered that he might have other biological children in the world. And he is a very thoughtful person who is, who thinks deeply about bioethics and medical ethics. It had never occurred to him. So I knew that it would, that in all likelihood it would have to be a shock, and I tried to write a note that tempered that shock to some degree. We have a lot in common. Now, does he feel like my father? No, my father feels like my father. He raised me. But he does feel like, as I describe it in the book, he feels like the country I come from. That is actually, that's the language that came to me after I first met him. He feels like the country I come from that I've never set foot in, and I've never tasted its food, and I've never sat on its beaches, and I've never climbed its mountains, but I'm from there.
Danny, thank you for sharing this intimate journey with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
So that concludes our first pandemic taping of Beyond the Page. Wherever you are listening to this, I hope you and your loved ones are staying safe. Thanks for going on this little journey with us. To hear Danny's unedited conversation with Abraham, to explore the free archive of Sun Valley Writers Conference recordings, and to learn more about the conference, please visit svwc.com. I'm John Burnham Schwartz. Take good care, and thanks so much for listening. Be well.
Beyond the Page is produced by John Burnham Schwartz and James Tooley. Original music by Dean Grinsfelder, and production support provided by Jay Shilliday and the Network Studios.